To be a resident of the United States is not the same as being a citizen. Citizens have access to rights and benefits we don't give to immigrants until they are naturalized, including the right not to be deported under any circumstances. But when did immigration status turn into a litmus test for basic rights? From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Sarah R. Coleman is Assistant Professor of History at Texas State University. She's been studying how the 1965 Hart-Celler Act radically changed immigration trends in the U.S. just ahead of the outsourcing of manufacturing that left millions of Americans feeling less secure about their own economic prospects. As we'll hear, those shifts made immigrants a convenient stand-in for the anxieties of globalization and changed how both progressives and conservatives think about what immigrants deserve. Her book is called The Walls Within, The Politics of Immigration in Modern America. Sarah, welcome to Think.
Chris, thank you so much for having me, and I'm honored to be here today.
Have we always drawn a sharp line between the rights of people who live in the United States but don't have citizenship as opposed to those who do?
We haven't. And, you know, that's what's really interesting to me and part of why I wrote this book is I think many people in America have very limited understandings of the ways in which it's really only in the last sort of 30 years that there's been this sharp line between those who are citizens of the United States, those who are not citizens, those who have either legal permanent resident status or who are unauthorized immigrants in the United States.
When did the federal government first start trying to control or police immigrants and immigration?
So, the federal government really, it begins in the 1880s, primarily actually with Asian exclusion. It's the first time that you see the federal government start to put regulations on the book about admissions policy. Before that, it's actually mainly a state issue. Particularly, we see this in colonial times, it's New York and Massachusetts. But it's not until the 1880s that we start to see the federal government take a series of actions to start regulating immigration enforcement.
So a lot of what exists today in terms of policies and attitudes about non-citizen immigrants dates back to the Hart-Celler Act of 1965. Can you remind us of what that law did, why it was enacted, and what sort of correction it was meant to provide to immigration policy dating back to the 1920s?
Right. So 1965 and the Hart-Celler Act is really a critical year in immigration history and the history of the United States more broadly, particularly right because of the passage of this Hart-Celler Act. And what it is it's a key piece of legislation in Lyndon Johnson's Great Society. And what it does is it ends the national quota system of the 1920s, and it launches a new era in immigration, and it remakes the nation's demographic profile over the next four decades. And it's approved by Congress in the same year as the Voting Rights Act and just a year after the Civil Rights Act of 1964. And it's sort of passed under this ethos of civil rights and fairness. And what it does is it gets rid of some of the race-based immigration quotas of the 1920s, and it sets a uniform cap on all nations for the purposes of immigration. And in an effort to promote uniformity, the Hart-Celler Act also introduced for the first time a cap on immigration from the Western Hemisphere. In the 1920s, immigration from the Western Hemisphere hadn't been capped because of the interests of Southwestern agricultural and agribusiness, right? They wanted to maintain continued access to cheap immigrant labor. And thus, in 1965, while the overall cap is going to rise, what we see is the volume of legal immigration from Mexico actually falls, leading to a sharp increase in deportations. But I think what's really interesting about the Hart-Celler Act, more than sort of these actual numerical quotas, is that it really starts to sort of reshape American society and culture. And it launches these deep debates that I look at over the place of the immigrant in American life. Because as controlling admissions to the United States at this moment, beginning in 1965, across its southern border becomes very difficult, you see the battle to control immigrants shift from these external borders to internal ones.
So in other words, punish the people who made it across the border without permission rather than and not quite give up on trying to keep them from coming in, but recognize that if you want to make a point, you're going to have to do it with the immigrants who've arrived.
Exactly. Exactly. So as they realize that this, they're going to continually try and stop across sort of transborder migration. But they come to realize that, as many have now realized, the border is quite porous, right? And so in some ways, the new battle was formed over kind of what access they have to rights in the United States.
So before Hart-Celler, there was not this sort of widespread, if very inaccurate, perception that a lot of people of Latino descent might be related to people who are in the country illegally?
I mean, I think so. I think there's an important distinction to be made, right? There's always been anti-Latino sentiment in the United States, you know, throughout, and it comes in waves, right? We're going to see a big wave of it in the 1930s around the Great Depression. We're going to see another big wave in the 1950s. But I think what's interesting at this moment is it sort of gets the notion, and the historian May Nye is particularly an expert on this, right? The idea is before this, there wasn't that idea that this immigration itself was quote unquote illegal, right? Because there wasn't this cap. So there wasn't the same sort of notion of illegal immigration. So it wasn't sort of that same moment. Does that make sense?
It does. So at the time it was passed, Hart-Celler looked like a clear progressive victory. What makes you say that it's simultaneously progressive and also deeply conservative?
Right. So I think it's deeply conservative first, right? And then it puts a cap in for the first time on the Western Hemisphere. But the thing that I think is even more interesting, right, is it launches a whole new anti-immigrant movement in the United States. Whereas so many people have focused, right, on this question of the border, it's with the Hart-Celler Act that you start to see a real focus on attacking immigrants who are already in the United States, right? And you start to see the anti-immigrant movement sort of emerge that really sort of focuses on the growth of the Latino and unauthorized populations, which are all too often seen as one and the same, as the cause of these issues, the large issues going on in the United States. And this new anti-immigrant movement takes hold that effectively argues that not only were immigrants taking jobs away from native-born Americans, but they were also taking away government benefits and sort of access to citizenship.
So what kinds of benefits have we tried to deny non-citizen immigrants in the past 30 years or so?
So my work focuses on four main areas. So education rights, labor rights, the social safety net, sort of access to sort of a bunch of the sort of public benefits that we consider in crime. I think most of your listeners would likely be surprised by this fact, which is between 1935 and 1971, no federal laws barred non-citizens, even unauthorized immigrants, from Social Security benefits or unemployment insurance or ADC, which after 1962 became known as AFDC, Aid to Families with Dependent Children. And in particular, when new programs are created, like the food stamp program or Medicaid, the same rules apply, right? So it's not until the 1970s that under federal law, both authorized and unauthorized immigrants are eligible for these programs on the same basis as citizens. And it's beginning in the 1970s that you start to see the first serious legislative efforts to restrict immigrants' access to these programs.
Is it reasonable to assume that people looked around and saw a lot more immigrants coming from places other than Europe and started to realize that they wanted to limit equivalent benefits to immigrants?
Yeah, I think you look and you say, okay, so what's changing if you kind of step back a step and you say, beginning in 1965, 1970, sort of after the Hart-Celler Act, we have a dramatic reshaping of what rights we think immigrants are entitled to in the United States. What's changing, right? It's the racial demographic of that immigrant population, right? And race plays a key role in changing sort of what the notion is that immigrants have rights and what they're entitled to in the United States.
It's so ironic because Hart-Celler was deliberately written to look race neutral.
Exactly. But it ends up having these far-reaching consequences that aren't.
So I want to talk a little bit about employment here. How do employment restrictions on immigrants get enforced? Like, who's more likely to get in trouble with the law when an undocumented person is hired for a job, that immigrant or their employer?
So unfortunately, it's that immigrant today, but that's not really sort of how it was originally envisioned. So what you see is during the 1970s, you see a movement. There's a bunch of changes in the labor pattern, right, in the United States. we see working and middle-class Americans entering a new era, right? A new, you start to see the rise of the service-oriented low-wage economy. And it leads many citizens economically insecure, right? The world is changing and it's hard for a lot of people. And for many working and middle-class white and black citizens, they view this massive growth of Latino and unauthorized populations as the cause of inequality. And what you start to see is groups begin to push for efforts called employer sanctions, which is a category of restrictions that penalizes businesses for employing unauthorized workers. And much of that initial support for employer sanctions actually comes from many on the left, which is often surprising to people, who viewed employer sanctions as a way to protect domestic labor markets. So think of groups like the AFL-CIO or the Urban League. But what happens over time is they sort of really push these developments of employer sanctions in the 70s and the 80s. And they get written into law in the 1986, the very famous Immigration Reform and Control Act, President Reagan's immigration bill. But they're not enforced at all. All the enforcement mechanisms against businesses are stripped from the bill. So what you end up seeing is that you have this law on the books, but employers aren't the ones who end up getting penalized. All the enforcement mechanisms are taken out. And what you see instead is that those who are unauthorized in the United States are more likely to be charged.
You note that although we think of immigration and our arguments over it as a kind of left-right divide, there is a wide chasm within the Democratic Party and within the Republican Party. What are the kinds of things that Democrats argue over with regard to how we should do immigration in this country?
Right. I think this shifts, there's what you see between 1965 and 2000 is a big shift within the Democratic Party, right? And the Democratic Party is fractured. In the 70s, as I mentioned, groups like the AFL-CIO, the Urban League, and others are really on the restrictionist side, right? They're the ones pushing for immigration, increased immigration enforcement, right? They're oftentimes, the UFW, the United Farm Workers, is one of the main supporters of employer sanctions, arguing that unauthorized immigration makes organizing farm workers more difficult because unauthorized workers were used as scab labor during strikes. But what you start to see during the period and toward the middle of the end of the 70s and the 80s is you're going to start to see a big shift, particularly in the Democratic Party. And groups like the AFL-CIO and the UFW are going to finally reverse course and call for the repeal of employer sanctions. And we're going to start to see more of a coalescing within the Democratic Party towards a pro-immigration stance. That doesn't mean that everyone in the Democratic Party, right, is going to be unified. And we see that today, right? There's going to be different questions, from everyone, from those who are going to call to disband ICE, right, versus other sort of sides of the Democratic Party. And we're seeing a lot of pressure on Biden on that at this moment, right? But we're also going to see divides in the Republican Party. And sort of that's why I think immigration is such a difficult issue and why we deal with immigration reform over and over and over again is because the parties are so fractured. Like, for example, in the Republican Party, you're going to have a huge debate between, as I mentioned, on employer sanctions in the 80s, right, under Reagan. Reagan is going to strip enforcement of employer sanctions because he wants sort of more of this deregulatory free market side of the party. He's going to sort of drive the Republican Party at that moment. But in the 1990s, it's a different wing of the Republican Party that's going to be driving immigration policy. And that's going to be much more of the traditional nativist, restrictionist element that's going to come to power under Newt Gingrich. And so I think part of why these reform moments are so difficult is because there's this fracturing within both parties sort of over this entire time period. And some of the legacies remain with us today.
So pro-business Republicans are apt to be more tolerant of immigrants than those who want to restrict immigration based on other factors like concern over how the culture of the country might change.
Mm-hmm. Because they want continued access to labor at this moment.
How do current...
And we see that today, right? And we're going to see that on the question of, the two bills that are going through the House, that have went through the House last week, right? The Republicans generally have broad bipartisan support around the farm worker, around farm workers and around Dreamers.
How do current immigration laws define immigrants who are likely to be public charges?
Right. So what we see is under President Donald Trump, pushed to the forefront this issue of the so-called likely to become public charge rule. And just to back up for your listeners a little bit, right? We've for a long time had on our laws something called the likely to be public charge rule, which is if you use certain elements of the social safety net, you're less likely, they can be used against you in your application for legalization or sort of access to citizenship. This was actually sort of, most of this was put on the books under President Clinton in 1996. But it was left very vague. And what we start to see under Donald Trump is he starts to include a broader swath of benefits that are allowed to be sort of used in that calculation to consider who might become likely to become public charge.
Why are so many working class, native-born Americans likely to view unauthorized immigrants as being bad for their economic prospects?
I think this is a moment, and we've seen this since the 70s, when many working and middle class Americans are struggling, right, with the new service oriented low wage economy. And I think you see an anti-immigrant movement arise at this moment that is very appealing in that it sort of argues that they're taking jobs and benefits away. And I think a lot of people look, for a scapegoat to sort of address the problems that they're facing at that moment without really addressing sort of the larger economic trends that are causing these, their own economic issues.
So larger economic trends like globalization and outsourcing of certain kinds of jobs to other places where labor is cheaper.
Exactly.
So if we can't stop globalization around the world and immigrants become, undocumented immigrants especially, become a kind of scapegoat for these macroeconomic changes, what's the effect on the experiences of immigrants?
Right. We've seen a massive shift in various areas in terms of rights, right? We see, immigrants' rights activists have been successful in some areas, and particularly in maintaining access to education. And we've seen particularly around education and access of students. But like, I think there's been a huge shift in terms of what people have access to in terms of labor rights and in terms of, their ability of the federal government in terms of access to the social safety net, in terms of sort of civil liberties protections, and all these areas where the state touches individuals' lives.
How did the civil rights movement set us up for the ways we currently try to delineate the rights of citizens versus non-citizens?
So the civil rights movement really does a number of things for the immigrants' rights movement, right? I think, so one of the cases that I talk about is the fight over education for undocumented children. And that actually is a fight that begins in the 1970s here in Texas. And it starts in Tyler, Texas, which is a small town in the eastern part of the state, where a local school board announced in 1977 that unauthorized students would only be able to attend Tyler Public Schools if they paid a tuition fee of about $1,000, which in today's money is around between $4,000 and $5,000. And as families struggled with this new policy, they're connected with two young civil rights lawyers who worked in the area. And they start gaining a lot of support, not only from these local civil rights workers, but from a national network of civil rights attorneys, and particularly the Mexican American Legal Defense and Education Fund. And so what you see is coming out of the civil rights movement of the 1950s and 60s, right? You start to see immigrants' rights lawyers, both in Tyler and, MALDEF more nationally, turn to these models of the civil rights movement. And they start framing these immigrants' rights cases very much following sort of the Brown v. Board of Ed model, right? They turn to these arguments, right, that these are the 14th, turning to the 14th Amendment arguments, and they sort of look at students, particularly, right, educational rights for unauthorized children, as sort of the strongest vessel through which to challenge restrictive legislation, sort of embracing a strategy seen to have worked in Brown v. Board of Ed. So what you start to see is immigrants' rights activists really turn to the civil rights movement as a model for an effective way to push immigrants' rights.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. So did that model for pushing immigrants' rights affect the justifications courts have used for requiring that non-citizen children be given access to publicly funded schools?
I'm sorry, you cut out in the middle of that. Can I hear the end of it?
Yeah. Did what justification have courts given for requiring that non-citizen children be given access to publicly funded schools?
Right. So it's actually a 5-4 decision in 1982, and the court sides with students and their families, and it strikes down the Texas statute denying funding. And it doesn't necessarily call it a direct right, but in the decision, Justice Brennan famously writes, right, it's difficult to understand what the state, quote, hopes to achieve by promoting the creation and perpetuation of a subclass of illiterates within our boundaries, right? And so it sort of creates this idea. It's the reason that, you know, K through 12 education is sort of for unauthorized children is still on the books because of the Plyler case. It's going to have a backlash, right? It's this moment in the 1980s where sort of, I think a lot of rights activists see it as a big stepping stone on their way to expanding immigrants' rights in other areas, but it's going to turn sort of push a backlash where a lot of rights groups are going to see this as sort of rights groups on the right are going to see it as a sort of a gross expansion of the rights revolution of the 60s.
Of course, no state or local government can offer anything like a path to citizenship, but I'm curious about the sort of opening that federal stalemates leave for state and local governments to take some aspects of immigration policy into their own hands.
Right. I think this is one of the things that I think is really interesting about this moment, what's happened since the 1990s, right? And so what you see actually is in the 1990s, states increasingly, right, well before sort of Sheriff Joe Arpaio or anything that was going on in Arizona, we see that states have a much longer history of shaping immigration policy. And basically beginning in the 1990s, I show how both California pressures the federal government to change its policy around the social safety net. And I also look at how in Iowa, right, in Iowa surrounding some issues on the ground, Iowa pushes for the delegation of authority to state and local law enforcement to do immigration policy. And so well before sort of Sheriff Joe Arpaio in Arizona, we see in the 1990s, states starting to drive immigration policy in a very concrete way. And in the 1990s, right, it's definitely on the restrictionist side. And you see it in California, you see it in Iowa, and you start to see it in other places across the United States. What we've seen is sort of immigrants' rights activists have learned from what restrictionists did really well in the 90s. And certain states, like California, right, are pushing immigrant inclusion in a new way that we sort of hasn't really been highlighted as much, but really we start to see immigration sort of inclusion and sort of new access pushed by states. You see this on everything from driver's licenses or access to Obamacare exchanges, sort of really immigrant integration in new ways. And so definitely beginning in the 1990s, but we start to see it, you know, we still see it today on both sides. States are pushing more and more on immigration policy.
We think about border states like Texas and Arizona and California as having an effect on federal policy. You know, the inclusion of Iowa in that list tells us that it's something broader than that.
And I think that's part of a shift that we initially see after 1986. And so what we see in 1986 with the IRCA bill, the President Reagan's, right, there's an authorization of citizenship for 3 million people. And what one of the things that social scientists have found is that after that, there's a huge movement of populations within the United States. When people are authorized, they generally, you know, express movement. They're less scared of detection, and they're going to move. Also, industry is shifting, right? A lot of meatpacking that's going around, happening in the country is now happening in states like Georgia or in Iowa, for example. And so what we traditionally think of as border states, right, are no longer the ones on the border. And these questions of immigration enforcement, right, whereas border states often have, right, CBP and other types of enforcement are sort of now being debated in the heartland, right? And I think the immigration conversation, right, does not just happen at the border. And I think it's sort of, it's happening across the country in a new way, beginning in the 90s.
What changed in the 90s to make citizenship status so important in terms of anyone's ability to claim basic rights to government programs and services?
Right, so in the 1990s, California voters, to sort of back up for a moment, right? So we know that between 1935 and 1971, there were no federal laws barring non-citizens, even unauthorized immigrants, from much of the social safety net. During the 1970s, we start to see a move where you target unauthorized immigrants. But it's really in the politics that changed in the 1990s, and it's this moment in the 90s where citizenship status becomes a litmus test for basic rights. And that's because what happens is California voters overwhelmingly support a ballot initiative called Proposition 187, which prohibits unauthorized immigrants from accessing public benefits. And federal courts eventually invalidate many of the proposition's provisions, but the measure's popularity drives national policy. And President Clinton sees what's happening in California, right? And he's just won California for the first time in a very long time. And he's heading into a 1996 reelection. And it's a very content, he's very worried, right? He's only won California because Ross Perot took 20% of the vote, right? He only won 46% of the vote in California. And so he's very worried about losing California in 1996. And he sees this groundswell of anti-immigrant sentiment in California. And Republicans in Washington are pushing welfare reform. And they're pushing an effort to remove authorized immigrants from much of the social safety net. And Clinton, under pressure from the electoral politics of California and sort of the pressures of Newt Gingrich and this new contract with America, goes along with this. And in 1996, under welfare reform, the federal government bars states from using federal funds to provide Medicaid, food assistance, and other key social safety net programs to the majority of recent legal immigrants, right? They also passed new guidance for the public charge rule we talked about earlier. And it's at this moment in the 1990s that this new restrictive era begins, in which citizenship, rather than resident status, becomes the new boundary for access to certain rights.
How did that change immigration rates? Did people come to this country, especially undocumented people, in smaller numbers after they were denied the possibility of accessing those benefits?
You know, what it does actually is it spurs a huge rise in people who are already here, who are like are naturalizing, people who already had green cards. Because they're worried about sort of access to benefits, but it's not actually, doesn't do a sort of, it's nothing, it's not a game changer in why people come here, right? I think a lot of the debate, you know, there was some news reporting last week about whether people at the southern border at this moment are coming because Biden's president now because of Trump. I think it's sort of a similar question, right? The huge crush of people coming from the Northern Triangle countries at this moment aren't coming because Biden is president. They're coming because, you know, they're facing huge crime and corruption. They're facing huge lack of access to opportunity, enormous poverty in countries like El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala, right? We have the huge impact of these hurricanes. And so the access to these benefits in the 1990s is not going to kind of move the needle on why people are coming. People are coming because of the problems that they're facing in their home countries.
Sarah, are naturalized citizens indistinguishable from native-born Americans in their access to rights and privileges?
In many ways, yes. Right. And so I think what's interesting is citizenship in nowadays has taken on such a deep, deep meaning in ways that it was much more fluid in earlier time periods, right? The question of, you know, in the 1970s, the distinction that's made is about how you came to the United States, right? Was it authorized or unauthorized is where the federal government really starts to make that distinction. And by the 90s, it's really moved to a question not of how you entered the country, but whether or not you have citizenship rights.
It's interesting to think that that difference in terms of rights might actually be driving people to seek naturalization who might otherwise have continued living here and been satisfied to live as just green card holders.
Yes, and that's what you see in 1996, is you're going to see a large move towards naturalization, right? Which, you know, I don't think people anticipated in the 1990s, right? And it's at the time when I say now to my students, right, that California was a swing state in the 90s, they're like, how could that be possible, right? But it's this anti-immigrant movement in 94, right, is really going to push the naturalization that's going to sort of make this groundswell in state level politics. It's really going to shift it far, far to the left.
What should lawmakers take into account when they're deciding what rights and benefits to allow or deny immigrants?
You know, I think it's a tough question in terms of, you know, when you get down to the nitty gritty, but I think at the end of the day, immigrant populations, right, are contributing to the United States, to our society. They're a key part of our economy. They're a key part of our communities. And I think to sort of ignore that conversation and just sort of separate them out and sort of just pretend that they can only be used for their labor is a horrible conversation and a sort of something that we can't do, right? Immigrants both live in the United States and make these essential contributions to both our economy and society. You know, we've seen this during the pandemic, right, with all of the essential workers. And I think we really need to include them in the way that they are valued, the way that we value them.
It's interesting because even progressives sometimes will reduce their pro-immigrant argument to these folks will do jobs that nobody else wants to do.
Yeah, it's a sort of an interesting conversation that people have. And I think people need to remember that this is, you know, this debate, this wasn't a debate 40 years ago, right? Like the conversation is really a new one, and we can have a longer conversation about that. But, you know, history reminds us that it's possible to do things in a way that's different from today, right? And hopefully, right, we can make better decisions and than we have in the past. And in some ways return to where we were. I think sort of Biden has this opportunity at this moment, right, to move beyond a piecemeal unwinding of the Trump border and admissions agenda. And he has an ability to address this legacy sort of this 40-year assault on the place of immigrants in the United States. And I think by thinking more about these fights over immigrants' rights and how these fights that we're having today are very different than what we saw 40 years ago, we learn these lessons from history might guide us forward, sort of, and present a different way than for Biden to go.
Sarah R. Coleman is assistant professor of history at Texas State University and author of The Walls Within, The Politics of Immigration in Modern America. Sarah, thank you for spending this hour with us.
Thank you so much for having me, Chris. I really enjoyed it.
Think is a production of KERA in Dallas. Our team includes Stephen Becker, Paige Phelps, Anna Perez, Nilofer Arsala, and Micaela Rodriguez. Our interns are Madison Hurd, Sriya Reddy, and Rolando Hernandez. You can listen to Think wherever you get your podcasts. As always, I'm Chris Boyd. Have a great day.